Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 146 of the podcast, everybody, with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel, my co-host. We're splitting this week's episode down the middle. We begin by talking about the worst supercars we've ever driven. They do exist. Quite a few of them, actually. And then later on, we're catching up with Paul Darville from Bonhams to talk about the highlights in Bonhams' forthcoming auction in Paris later this week. So please enjoy the episode. First things first, Andrew, I just want to talk about last week's episode, a daft game for petrol heads.
Yeah, we need more.
We need to do more, but we need to make improvements. Now, I dreamt up the game in 20 minutes or something, the Sunday evening before we actually recorded it.
Yes.
And so I think we have something. It was quite fun. Lots of people have been in touch to say they enjoyed it. And here are some ways it can be improved. So we've got some good ideas for making it fundamentally a better game. One of those is one chap, sorry, I didn't make a note of your name, but someone got in touch to say they're a bit of a games nerd. And one important aspect of a good game is what he called incomplete information. And his point there was that we shouldn't come up with 10 driving scenarios. We should come up with 20 and only draw half of those out of the hat. So that it makes it, I guess, a bit less predictable. We don't know what's coming. So a few of you have been in touch.
It also means the dice aren't massively loaded in your favour from the start because you know exactly what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. So it makes it more fair, less predictable.
Yeah.
So we've had a few ideas like that for making it a better, more robust game. And this is great. You know, we'll do another one soon with these improvements. And it's brilliant because, you know, when we're struggling for a podcast topic, which happens sometimes because we do this every week.
Surely not.
We can play a game and we can rope in some of our contributors from time to time, play the game with them. It's good, isn't it? I think we just keep doing it. So this week this is a two-part episode. We're talking about the worst supercars that we've ever driven.
Yes.
And later on, we're going to talk to Paul from Bonhams about their forthcoming sale in the next few days. There's some superb stuff up for auction. But let's talk worst supercars. This is your idea. I think probably you will have driven more crap supercars than I have. There are a few modern ones that I can think of. But is it fair to say that most of the world's crap supercars are older than they are newer?
Well, probably, because there was a time, wasn't there, when simply the fact that a car was fast and looked amazing kind of covered a whole... It was a decent enough excuse to cover a whole litany of flaws. Like, you couldn't see out of it, and they didn't ride very well, and they broke down a lot. And, you know, increasingly, that's no longer the case. But there's also the counter-argument, which says that, you know, as cars improve, which they unquestionably have, so should our expectations of them, you know, rise by a commensurate amount. So... yeah, I mean, I guess most of them will be older, but I certainly wouldn't ever dream of saying that there's no such thing as a rubbish supercar anymore, because it's absolutely not the case. But I suggest we start and see how we get on.
Okay, I've got a handful on my list, not too many, but give us one of yours. I mean, what era are you choosing for your first one?
Okay, well, I mean, the first one I'm going to go for is, and I've mentioned this on the podcast before, and, you know, Harry, who's got one of these things, often sort of points out that it's, they're not all like that, but a Lamborghini Countach. And I say this only because it's the car that I kind of grew up with. It was the ultimate sort of, you know, if you're a child of the 70s and the 80s, as I am, it was the ultimate thing to have on your bedroom wall. I can't remember a Countach ever going in a test up against a Ferrari or an Aston or a Porsche or whatever and not winning it. I got to drive one once. And it was just rubbish.
Wow, so we're going in hard, aren't we? I mean, if the Countach figures on this list, there's nothing sacred, because that is, for a lot of people, the supercar.
Okay, so I need to qualify. I need to qualify in two ways. Firstly, it was an LP500, so it was quite an early car. And, you know, the last cars, I understand, because I've not driven one, the Quattro Valvoles, the QVs, are massively better cars. And I completely accept, you know, the judgment of those who've driven them and who own them, that's the case. The second thing, as I suspect, the car I drove was a really bad example anyway. You just don't know what you're driving, do you? You just don't know whether they are absolutely representative of what they are or whether they're just, you know, really poorly maintained. And I suspect the one that I drive was in the latter category, but I can only report as I found. Mm. Some stuff won't change. The fact that it was just like really, really cramped, and you couldn't see out of it, and the ergonomics were a joke. It doesn't matter whether the car's in good or bad condition. That's going to be the same, come what may. And the other stuff. I mean, the handling scared me a bit.
I can well imagine that.
It just felt not brilliantly developed, certainly not the sort of thing I felt like sort of skidding around a bit. It came on those massive, 3, 4, 5, 35 section Pirellis, and something much narrower at the back. And I seem to remember it understeered a lot. But more than anything else, it just wasn't very fast.
Mm.
Yeah.
How much, off the top of your head, how much power do you know? Is it 400, something like that?
No, I think those are the later ones. So I think a QV is about, on paper, is about 455 horsepower. I think these were sort of late 300s, but they weren't very heavy cars. It certainly should have, if, you know, the Lamborghini figures of the day were an accurate reflection of what the engine was producing. Well, either they weren't an accurate reflection of what the engine was producing, or that engine wasn't producing them, one of the two, because it didn't feel like anything like that strong. And I suspect there's probably a bit of both going on. We all know that, you know, Ferrari and Lamborghini in the 70s and the 80s were, how can I put this? They always sort of accentuated the positive as far as their power outputs were concerned. And I suspect this one probably didn't even have as much power as it was meant to have, let alone what it was claimed to have. So, so I feel a bit bad about putting it forward. But I guess because it is one of those sort of iconic cars, I thought I'd just sort of, you know, get it out there straight away.
I've not driven a Countach. I've driven an LM002, which has the Countach engine. Clearly a very different car, much heavier car. But I was amazed at how fast it didn't feel. It wasn't, you know, it's not a fast car. And so that engine, I mean, it's got this stonking great V12 in it, but it doesn't go that hard.
No.
And I can well imagine that even in something like a Countach, much lighter, much lower kind of car, probably still not wildly accelerative, but then we are used to modern cars that are so ridiculously fast.
Yeah.
So it does sound like we need to get you in a better example of a Countach.
Yes.
And that's a story in itself, isn't it? You having another go in the Countach and seeing if you can actually discover exactly why people love them so much.
Yeah.
So we'll try and do that this year.
I'd really, really love to. I would really love to. I'd love to come back on this podcast and go, guys, I was wrong.
I get it now.
I get it now. I understand why everyone went nuts about these cars. Because I've driven the other cars that it was kind of up against at the time. I mean, the Ferrari Boxer, which is, you know, the one that was always going up against the Countach and always losing to the Countach. And I think it got quite a bad reputation as a result. And I've driven a Boxer, which I don't think was a very good Boxer. It was a Carburetta 512, which is probably the one not to have. And, you know, I think it was probably a reasonable example. It probably wasn't as bad an example as the Countach was, but there was certainly nothing, you know, I didn't want one of these cars you get into it and think, wow, this feels like a new car. But I quite liked it, you know, because you could see out of it and it wasn't completely insane. And it felt to me, it felt to me like a supercar. Insofar as it was something, a car that rather than just sort of show off to your mates and go, oh, look at me, I've got an amazing looking car. You could do a distance in it. You could put stuff in it. It rode well. And it had this amazing V12 engine, which did feel powerful. And all sorts of things about it, which I really, really liked in a way that I didn't with the Countach. So, yes, if there was any way, I would love to drive a really good Countach and come back on here and go, I got it wrong.
Normally when we say that, at least one person will get in touch. So hopefully someone's listening and the offer will come our way to be revisited. Well, okay, I'm going to keep it on the Lamborghini thing then. And my first nomination, I've never really got on with the Aventador. Other than the SVJ.
Yes, I agree.
Actually, I've only driven the SVJ Roadster, but I've driven two examples, one in North Wales, and I just thought it was one of the most thrilling road cars I'd ever driven. I stepped out of it shaking like a leaf. And then I drove another one at Lamborghini's ice driving school up in the Italian Alps, which is a ridiculous place to drive a car like that, but it was fantastic fun. And so I think the SVJ Roadster is a superb car, but every other example of the Aventador is just a bit frustrating. They feel enormous and heavy, flat-footed. You know, there's no real sense of connection. It's very difficult to feel like you're getting right on top of the car, like you trust that it's right there beneath you. And when you drive one alongside a McLaren or a mid-engine Ferrari, and those cars give you so much confidence and you have so much faith in them, and you feel like you can take them by the scruff and really chuck them at the road, you realise how far short the Aventador
You're absolutely right. I mean, I wrote the first Aventador road test for Autocar. So I drove a lot in the UK. Before that, I'd gone down to Vallelunga, where they launched it. I remember the gearbox, that robotized manual gearbox. I mean, it was so vicious when you put it in whatever it was, Corsa mode, that there was a quick corner which you had to take, which was flat, but you had to take an upchange through Vallelunga, and it would destabilize the car because there was such a bang in that. And you know, and it's, you can't see out the thing properly. And you know, if you compare that to particularly to McLarens and also to Ferraris, I think they're such big wide things, you can't drive them with any confidence.
No, you can't.
The SVJ though, I do agree, that was actually pretty wondrous. Because it was so fast and there was such a sense of occasion, and it just felt together. And this is not the first example of this, of Lamborghini doing this. You're too young to have driven it, but the Diablo was exactly the same. You know, a standard four-wheel drive Diablo VT, not a nice car. Not a nice car at all. But there were two special editions I drove, one very trick called an SE30, and then there was the Diablo SV, which was almost like the Diablo Club Sport, because they'd taken some weight off it and that sort of thing. And they were just terrific. And you could really get up them and really, you know, throw them around and enjoy them. And so it's almost like Lamborghini have always known how to do this. And then right to, you know, towards the end of whichever model it is, their production line. And maybe that's the same with the Countach as well, with the QVs. They just suddenly go, well, actually, yeah, this is what this is what it should have been all along.
Well, yeah, what's amazing actually is that they are all the same basic car, but with less weight, with some really deft chassis tuning. Some other bits and pieces. They can transform them. It's amazing how much you can change the character of a car just by tuning it.
I mean, another example, and this is another one that I was going to mention in the course of this podcast, the current Audi R8. You know, when they first produced that rear-wheel drive one, it went from being one of the most disappointing. I can remember we were doing a group test with Autocar when McLaren 570S came out, and it just came last by such a ridiculous margin, you know, to the point you kind of wonder why it was there. And then the rear-wheel drive one came out, and it was cheaper, and just suddenly it just felt completely together. And I just thought, this is a great, great car. Mm. And they hadn't done much more than just, you know, made it correct wheel drive.
Yeah, it made a big difference to that car.
Massively.
And you can still get them. And they, yeah, because the first one was a kind of limited edition, wasn't it?
It was.
And that now went,
I think it was just really, really popular. So they thought, well, we can flog a few of these.
It's a bit awkward for Audi, isn't it? Built its entire brand on four wheel drive, Quattro.
Yeah.
And yet we all think the best R8 is the one without it. But no, I completely agree. Okay, let me give you another one of mine. We're moving across Italy, but not very far.
Maranello. Or Modena. Where are we going?
We're going to Maranello.
Okay.
Ferrari 360 Spider.
Okay.
And what actually sticks out was just how flaky it felt.
Mm.
It didn't feel robust and solid, like it would last a long time, like you could dish out all manner of treatment to it and it would survive. It felt like a flaky car that was about to fall apart around you if you really pushed it hard.
Yeah, well, I haven't driven the Spider, but apart from the last one, again, apart from the Challenge Stradale, which was epic, but that was almost a racing car. The 360 just wasn't, they just weren't great for it. I can remember there was an autocar handling day, we were down at Goodwood, and just actually being really spooked by one of these things. Because they just didn't handle the way I wanted the car to handle. They were fine. They weren't like a 348, which is probably the worst Ferrari that's ever been made. And I'm probably not going to go on about that here because I've done it before and everybody knows. Which would just spin the moment it started to oversteer. And you couldn't even play about with that in a slow corner. 360 wasn't like that, but in quick corners, I don't know whether it was aero or setup or something, but you just turn into a quick corner, a really, really quick corner. Like Ford Water at Goodwood. And just when you wouldn't want it to, it would just start to ever so slightly oversteer. And that was on turning. And, you know, and you're doing 100 and goodness knows what miles an hour. And it's just, and suddenly all your confidence just goes. And you just find yourself coming around to the same corner the next lap thinking, I'm just not going to do that again. Mm. I'm not going to go in there at anything like that speed because I don't like being scared. and... At which stage, you know, the entire point of having that car on the track has gone. So you're completely right. That's a really good call.
Is this the episode that we kind of jumped the shark? Is this the one where we don't realise how lucky we are to get to drive these things? And
we jumped the shark a long time ago.
Terrible they are.
We jumped the shark about 50 episodes ago.
But it's okay to slay some icons, isn't it? And just
I think
sort
it's
of
important
reveal
because I think there's a perception out there that, you know, that because we get to drive this stuff, that there's kind of we're almost on a band to say tell everyone how wonderful it is. And it's, you know, and it's not always the case.
Mm. And we're doing this because we're doing this because we love the most exotic kinds of cars and they should be wonderful to drive.
Yeah.
And when they're not, we should call them out.
Absolutely.
So I hope this doesn't feel seem entitled or whatever, but I think
is.
It's important. So let's skip across the border into Germany.
Yeah. I'm going to get in trouble for this as well. Porsche 964 Carrera RS.
Ah.
Sorry,
interesting.
Dickie.
Yeah, Dickie Meaden has one.
Yeah. I think I've only driven the one that I road tested for Autocar, which was probably 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember I took it down to, this was back in the days when there wasn't a 40 mile an hour speed limit all over Dartmoor. And so we took it down there and shot it down there and did everything else. And I can remember coming back and seeing a sign to Exeter train station and thinking how wonderful it would be just to go to Exeter train station, get out of this thing and get on the train and take public transport back. And, you know, there aren't many cars that have made me want to do that. And the point was, you know, on a racetrack, I don't think I've driven one on a racetrack, but I'm sure it's just fabulous. Mm. And I know that there are things that people have done since it came out to get rid of its one fundamental problem on the road. The fundamental problem on the road was that it is so stiff, and particularly if you are of the fuller frame, the standard seats in it were so uncomfortable. Driving the car became a misery. And I don't, you know, I don't say that lightly. I can remember just being really physically uncomfortable in the car all the time because of the seats. And okay, you know, I'm a big bloke, but I'm not, you know, I'm not obese, and I'm, you know, I'm only 6'3". So I'm at the sort of upper scale of what, you know, anybody might regard as normal. And the suspension, I can remember, you know, driving it on actually what seemed to me to be quite smooth roads, and yet being really worried by every lump and bump you hit because it would physically deflect the car.
Mm.
You know, the suspension was so stiff, there was so little compliance that it affected that the ride affected the handling of the car. And goodness knows what it would have been like if it had been wet, particularly on, you know, whatever 30-year-old rubber it would have had on it at the time. And because it was just meant to be, and don't forget the context, you know, this is like 20 years on after the 2.7 RS, the sort of iconic 911, one of which I'd already driven by then and absolutely adored because it was so usable and so comfortable. And I just thought, they've just got it wrong. They've just made a racing car and put it on the road. And as we know, you know, racing cars on the road are almost as bad as road cars on the on a racetrack. And so, yeah, and I stand by it. I mean, lovely engine, love the dimensions, and everything else that's good about a 911. But they ruined it with the suspension settings. So there you go.
Okay, I'm going to take us to a country that you would not guess. You could sit there for 10 minutes and probably not guess this country. But we are hopping over to Eastern Europe. We're going to Bulgaria.
Oh, crumbs. Yeah. I don't think I've driven a Bulgarian supercar. I can name a Bulgarian supercar.
I've never seen another story about this car, so I might still be the only car journalist to have driven a Sin R1. If you don't know what that is, just Google it. You'll probably recognise it. I'm sure you've seen it on social media or online somewhere. But it's a curious-looking thing. It's called the Sin R1. Now, I don't want to just stick the knife in, because the Sin R1 really is one bloke who's developed his own supercar. And so, of course, it's not as refined as a Ferrari or a McLaren or a Lamborghini. Of course, when I drove it, it wasn't quite finished. Of course, it wasn't as reliable as all that stuff. But, okay, it had promise because it had a stiff space frame chassis. It had the right kind of suspension. It had, I believe it was a LS crate engine, so a big V8. It had a manual gearbox. And even when I drove it a few years ago, there weren't many cars left in that kind of market with an NA engine and a manual gearbox. So already it had some kind of benefits over the other cars that you might consider in that bracket. But it just wasn't finished when I drove it. So I only had a few laps on a short handling circuit. And the steering is super light and quick, but also vague. And it had so much front end on it that it would just get into a corner, but the rear couldn't keep up. And I spun it, you know, in like a second gear corner, just turned in and it just went. And it's a long old time since I've spun a car without trying to provoke it. And then before I could sort of begin to get really comfortable with it, the thing just started overheating. It was a mega hot day in Bulgaria. And the thing just started overheating. Things like the interior quality just wasn't there. The fit and finish of the buttons, nowhere near where it had to be. But because it was light, because it had the right kind of powertrain, the engine was in the right place, it had potential. I just don't think that Sin will ever have the resources or the wherewithal to actually go and realise that potential.
Okay, so I'm going to mention my version of that car. And I'm only going to be brief because no one will have heard of it and nothing came of it. But it was truly epically rubbish. There was a thing called, wait for it, the Cavini.
Okay.
Do you remember the Cavini?
No.
Okay. Italian supercar. You'd remember it if you saw a picture of it because it's got six wheels.
Bloody
that
hell.
Was its thing. Okay.
And it didn't catch on then?
Four at the front, two at the back. And I went out to, oh goodness, it was one of the longest days of my life, starting actually, and I just woke up in the morning to catch the first light out of Heathrow and discovered I lost my passport. But anyway, I found it, went out there. It wasn't working when we arrived. They finally got it going, got it out on the road. We must have driven, I don't know, 5 miles, and it just broke down, and that was it. We'd taken like two photographs, and I had to cobble together some kind of dry story out of it. And it was just one of those. It's just one of those cars where, you know, somebody's got an idea to do something which, you know, looks quite cool, but has absolutely no idea at all about the realities of doing it. And it was such a cobbled together mess of a thing. And they're quite nice materials they used, but none of them fitted properly. You couldn't fit in the car. You know, it was always going to break down. I was amazed, frankly, by the time we got out there and I saw the car that it worked at all. Didn't for long, and that was the end of the Covini.
What was literally the point of the six wheels?
Look cool.
That was it.
Okay, there are all sorts of arguments for six-wheelers. You can have, like, you know, an additional contact patch, additional swept area of your brakes. Smaller wheels means you can have a lower bonnet line, therefore you can get more front delt. It's all nothing to do with it. They just thought it looked cool. Mm. Do you remember the Panther 6?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it's that sort of thing. But I never drove a Panther 6, so I couldn't say whether that was rubbish or not, but this definitely was.
Okay, well, we don't have too much longer, so do you want to give us one or two more from your list?
Well, okay, so this is going to be, well, I know you've driven the race version and you loved it, Maserati MC12, the road car, lovely engine, cool looking thing, just terrible steering, just so light and so lacking in feel. And I say it again and again and again, if you're lucky enough to drive this stuff, actually, you know, a dream drive can turn into a nightmare if you have no confidence in the thing. Yeah, if you end up just having to drive it slowly because you don't know what the front end's doing and you just can't feel the car. Particularly with cars that are so wide and so difficult to see out of and take up so much space on the road and are so fast, you have to know exactly. And it's one of the reasons I'll say this freely. You know, I love McLarens is because they are so comfortable, so they don't get deflected by bumps. You can see out of them. You always know where you are. They have hydraulic steering, so the feel is fantastic. And, you know, and this was kind of like the opposite of that. So, yeah, that wasn't great. I'll never forgive the Jaguar XJR15 for not fitting in it.
So dreadful. How could
car.
They?
I take that car because I've never driven one, because I went to one. You know, it never even occurred to me that someone could build a road car that, okay, quite a tall bloke, but, you know, not a giant, literally wouldn't be able to physically fit in. I think it's the only road car that I've not been able to drive.
I think Henry drove one recently.
How did he drive one?
He must have just been more determined than you, because he's a tall bloke.
No, I couldn't drive it. I wasn't safe. I couldn't get my feet on the... You know, I think my feet went behind the bed. Well, maybe they took the seat out of the one he was in. I think, maybe. Yeah, because there were road cars and there were race cars. And if it was a race car and it just maybe had a bit of, you know, stuff moulded to the tub, that would... Because it's based on the Group C chassis, the XJR9 chassis. And I can drive those if I have to. So, well, if I have to, of course, I'm not. But they're not very comfortable, but I can do it. But I can't drive an XJR15.
Well, there you go. Crap right. Supercars. They are out there. I think hopefully we've called out a few of them. We spend long enough, don't we, talking about wonderful supercars. So why not talk about some rubbish ones as well? Okay, all right. Well, let's move on to Bonhams after this. As a car journalist, I spend lots of time far from home in airports and hotels using whatever Wi-Fi network is available. But I've started using NordVPN to protect my devices and data while traveling. It's easy to use, and best of all, I can still watch streaming services when I'm not at home. I can't tell you how annoying it is to be told I can't watch a Grand Prix or catch up on Top Gear just because I'm overseas. But now I can be halfway around the world and make websites and streaming platforms think I'm back at home in Bristol. We've partnered with NordVPN to offer you a massively discounted rate, and I mean more than 60% off the standard cost, plus 4 months for free. It's a hell of an offer. If you've been meaning to check out VPNs but haven't got around to it, just go and try NordVPN now. That's NordVPN. Take advantage of this offer at nordvpn.com/intercooler. Or you can click on the link in the description of this podcast. There's a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can try NordVPN risk-free. Right, let's get back to the podcast. Later this week, Bonhams has another one of its big auctions, this time in Paris. Le Grand Marc du Monde à Paris. Paul Darville, sorry, I've butchered that. You speak immaculate French, as we've just been hearing. Paul, you are head of collectors' cars department. So does that mean that you're in charge of finding the really special collectible cars to consign?
Absolutely. Well, a bit of that, and managing the sales as well, looking after the team and making sure that as a group and as an organisation, we're finding those cars and, importantly, of course, selling them, which is what this week's going to be all about.
Thanks for taking the time to join us and to talk about some of the stunning lots that will be going up for sale later this week. Head to bonhams.com if you want to know more. The auction gets going on the 1st of February, runs through to the 2nd of February.
And what we're on here talking about is a really very small fraction of all the stuff. I mean, looking through it, from all this, everything that you got from the pre-war era up to, you know, quite contemporary race cars, Formula One cars, that sort of stuff, it really does, you know, if you're really into the, it doesn't really matter what area you're into, there's going to be something there of interest, isn't there?
Absolutely. We've got nearly 200 cars being sold 2 days this week. Collection sale on the 1st, which is a single owner collection, principally pre-war there, which, as you say, Andrew, and motorbikes as well. And then the main sale, a little bit more modern, but there must be something in there for every taste, I think.
Can I just ask, what sort of qualifies a car as being fit for sale by Bonhams? Do you have any sort of, because presumably there are an awful, somebody came to you with, I don't know, a 1987 Ford Orion 1.6 LX, you probably go, thanks, but no thanks, wouldn't you?
I suppose, you know, 20 years ago, we would have talked about classic cars, or even 10 years ago. Now we talk about collectability. Yeah. So you do see cars in there. There's an Audi RS4 in there, a nice example, low mileage, you know, a relatively normal car, I suppose, but a nice low mileage one. It's not something that's easy to come by. And if we feel that it's something that our clientele are interested in, it's a complement to the rest of their collection, we'll consider it for auction. It's all about that collectability element, I think, that's probably the defining feature.
So this one is in Paris. Tell me, how does this auction compare to a Goodwood or a Monterey sale? Does it have a sort of specific character?
This sale, well, first of all, this sale is the biggest sale that Bonhams has ever put together. Oh, wow. In Europe. So our low estimate is just around 40 million euros. Historically, Paris has always been a really significant sale for us and, of course, some of our competitors because of Retromobile. Yeah. And it's always been an auction that historically for Bonhams has been quite pre-war focused. We wanted to keep that element in this auction because I think it's an important part of what Bonhams does. We're probably one of the few auction houses that can honestly say in Europe we have a speciality in the pre-war market. But we are also looking to reflect changes in the market, changing demand, and also bringing some of those more contemporary collectible cars. And then the final element this year, which I think we're going to talk about, is having Formula One cars in there, which ties in very nicely with our partnership with F1 Paddock Club. So it's it is, by virtue of its scale, quite a diverse sale, but there is still that theme of collectability and quality that should run through it.
Well, let's get stuck in with Formula One right away then. And I think this probably is the star consignment of the whole sale. 1991 Jordan 191. This is the car that Michael Schumacher made his F1 weekend debut in. He drove this car in first practice at the Spa, at the Belgian Grand Prix at Spa in 1991. And do you want to give us a bit of background, Andrew? So here's this young German kid who's done a bit of sports car racing. He arrives with a big reputation already in this gorgeous Jordan.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we owe it all to a bloke called Bertrand Gachot, who had that drive before Michael and then got into a spot of bother with a London taxi driver and was at the time detained at what was then Her Majesty's Pleasure. And EJ needed someone to come and pedal his car. And I think I'm right in saying, Paul, you may or may not know this, I don't think that Michael Schumacher had been to Spa before. He came over and he got in this thing and he had this extraordinary performance in qualifying. I think the car didn't finish the race, did it?
No, it was a burst of exuberance and raw talent, I think, in qualifying.
But it was enough for Flavio Briatore to take one look at this bloke and think, wow, we've got to have him. And without wishing to put too fine a point on him, he nicked him from under Eddie's nose, didn't he? And then that was, you know, that was Michael at Benetton and the rest is history. But, I mean, you know, this is a massively significant car. But it's also, I think, if you go and look at it, it's a stunningly beautiful car too. And the other thing, which most cars, Formula One cars of that era can't claim, it works, doesn't it?
Yeah. No, exactly.
It's got great get in it and have a go.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's good looking, great era, iconic livery. It's look, it's a very complicated racing car, but you're still, I suppose, in a semi pre-digital era. Yeah. It's something that is on a budget, we have to be honest, but usable. And what an important part of Schumacher's career and the story around him, and of course, therefore, F1 history. I think it's a great thing. And it's relatively rare that something of that significance comes up on the market at all.
I mean, to me, it's far more significant than, say, I don't know, a Ferrari or a Benetton, in which he actually won a race, because, you know, he won a great deal of races. But there's only, you know, one weekend where he made his debut. And this, you know, this is absolutely, you know, where the legend of Michael Schumacher, the Formula One driver, began. This very car, this very item, which to me gives it a significance and a specialness that, you know, even cars in which he went on to achieve far greater success don't have.
Absolutely,
there are lots of those.
Exactly, I suppose there's always a desire to own a Formula One winning car, you know, a race winning car.
Yeah.
But this car is in the story, as I say, in the legend, the building, the legend of Schumacher, far more significant, and it's unique. There can only be one. So it's an important thing.
So it's as we've said, it is a sensational looking thing. I think it's often held up, the Jordan 191, as the best looking Formula One car of all time. I'm not going to dispute that. I think it looks gorgeous, and it is a runner, as we've mentioned, and we know this because Mick Schumacher, Michael's son, drove it at Silverstone, I think last year, with our mate Karun Chandhok. He drove it as well. Your estimate for the car is 1.4 to 2 million euros. Is that conservative? Is there a chance it might go for more? Do you think that's about on the nose?
I think there's a chance it could go for more. I think it's a unique piece with a unique story. You put it, when you're valuing a car, I suppose you put it into context around it. You can say, what is a Grand Prix winning Schumacher for a Ferrari worth these days? You come in with a figure and you do use that as your high watermark and work back. But I think when you stack it up against a Grand Prix winning Ferrari from his career, this looks like tremendous value. And for somebody that's really passionate about Schumacher and about Formula One in this era, it's a very, very special thing. So it's one of the fascinating moments where I think an auction is so interesting, because it's not something quantifiable. You take your markers, you make your judgment, but ultimately the market has to speak. And that's what we're here to do to hear this week.
And do you have a sense of what the winning buyer might do with it? Does it sit in someone's living room looking very pretty, or does it get thrashed around Spa? What do you think?
I think these days there is a growing trend towards people using these cars.
Oh, fantastic.
I think younger collectors want to use and want to drive them. There's better support there for these vehicles than there ever was 10, 20 years ago. So I think there's a high probability that this car will return to track in some way. Whether it's ever raced hard is another matter, but I think it will come back into the public eye.
Brilliant. Well, I look forward to seeing what the 1991 Jordan 191 goes for. Such a significant car. But let's move it away from the racetrack to the road. The second car that we want to talk about, Andrew, is an early Ferrari F40. Now, can you explain the significance of a non-catalyst, non-adjustable F40?
Well, I mean, they're just regarded to be the purest. I mean, obviously, you don't need me to explain why, you know, not having a catalytic converter on the car you know, makes it a purer. And not having the adjustable front suspension was basically just a suspension lift which they put on the car to allow it to get onto, you know, sort of cross-channel ferries and that sort of thing. And I think, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the market regards those as being the sort of, because I guess the F40 was such a pure car, the purest of the pure. And what interests me about this car is it's guiding at 2.2 to 2.7 million euros. And I've just watched the value of these cars. I was once offered an F40 about 20 years ago. Not that I could have afforded it then, let alone now. But I can remember thinking to myself, well, they're never going to be worth a huge amount of money, because they made quite a few. They made about 1,300 cars compared to, I don't know, a 288 GTO where they made 272 or whatever. And I got that wrong, didn't I? So Paul, what is it about the F40, which is just, I mean, the prices seem to me to have, you know, doubled over the last few years, or is it this particular car so special?
I think the prices have doubled, I think, in the last 2-3 years. Yeah. I think that's partly generation, it's partly fashion, but you also need to consider, I suppose, 1,300 cars built. But once you knock out all the F40s that have had bumps, that have had incidents, fires, been repainted, yeah, if you're looking for a really great F40, yeah, you're down into the hundreds probably.
Yes,
so,
definitely.
And alongside growing demand. So I think the growth in prices is understandable in that sense. It's also, it's funny, we all said we were moving away from the track. An F40 is not so far away from the track, is it? It's quite mad that somebody actually built that as a road car in the late 80s. And I don't think you would get away with it now, of course. It's barely road legal in some respects, isn't it?
Yeah. I remember that Enzo Ferrari quote about it. Somebody asked him what it was like, and he replied, and this is the ultimate sort of PR nightmare quote. He said, "It's so fast you'll shit yourself."
Yeah, Enzo, I think that's probably fair.
And he must have been about 89 at the time that he said it. The fact is that, you know, lots of people, haven't there? Lots of motoring journalists, myself included, have just gone out and said over the years that despite all the, you know, the amazing hypercars and this, that and the other that come along, that actually, you know, faced with, you know, your last drive in your last car on your last road, you just go and get an F40 because they are just so wonderful.
And so you are partly responsible for the reason why none of us can afford an F40. So it really...
Okay, let's move it along on then. So we've gone from an early F40 to a late Porsche Carrera GT. Right, now this I consider to be my era. I've only driven one very briefly, thanks to our friend Andrew and business partner who happens to have a Carrera GT. So the reason I say it's my era is because I was reading about these cars in the magazines when I was... a teenager, and I just thought they were spectacular then. I think they're even more spectacular now. Paul, tell us a little bit about this Carrera GT. It looks like a very, very low mileage example.
It is indeed. It's as you get into these modern supercars, mileage is important. People really look for the least used, the closest to production. They are. Funny, there's a definite link with the F40 there. Why the low mileage F40s in great condition are worth considerably more than a higher mileage used example, and so collectors looking at buying Carrera GTs are looking at these cars now through the prism of F40s and that type of car as well. So they're looking to buy the best. I suppose in some ways a Carrera GT is a bit of a spiritual successor to an F40 as well. Highly developed, essentially race focused car for the road. I had a client who had an F40 who sold it and bought a Carrera GT and said it was the only car he could think of that reminded him in a much more refined way, an engineered way of the F40. So it's a different sort of buyer. We tend to sell these cars, to be absolutely honest with you, to people who don't use them because they're looking to preserve them as they are. They are people that want to build collections that are complete, and they're looking to buy the best, and that's where you see these low mileage examples also increasing in value quite dramatically.
Yeah, because I guess if you buy one of these super low mileage examples, you almost can't use it, can you? Because the reason you got it goes away, it doesn't become a super low mileage if you go and put 10,000 miles on it, you know, because you use it as your daily driver and you take it across Europe and that sort of thing. You'll have a lot of fun, but you're seriously damaging the collectability of the car, aren't you?
You are. And I think we do have clients who buy two, you know, find me a beautiful, perfect one that I'm going to put in my garage. And I'd also like one, if you can find me one that's got lots of miles on it, it's had an accident, that'd be great because I want to use it too. It's a talk about, a particular range of problems there. But it is a reality that these cars, unlike I think the Jordan in some ways, that stands a fair chance of being used. Bizarrely, the Carrera GT, essentially designed for the road, will probably not be used by its next owner.
Fascinating.
Let me just jump in. The Carrera GT is guiding at 1.4 to 1.8 million, which actually is almost exactly the same estimate for the Jordan 191, which, I don't know, that reveals something about the state of the market, doesn't it? The cars that are really cherished, because here we have a one-off, irreplaceable Formula One car with an amazing backstory, listing for much the same as a Porsche Carrera GT, one of 1,270 built, albeit a low mileage example. It's just curious that the rarity of the Jordan doesn't somehow make it worth 10 times more the Carrera GT. I just find it interesting.
I suppose broader appeal of the road cars, bigger, you know, there are multiple motivations for people that buy a Carrera GT. If you're buying a Jordan Formula One car, it really is passion, I think, largely, that's likely to drive that purchasing decision. And thank goodness that's still a factor in the market. We talk about prices a lot, but I think we're really lucky, all of us, to work in a business that is still fundamentally a hobby, and fundamentally a hobby that's driven by enthusiasm for the product. But when you get into Carrera GTs and those types of modern cars, you do have people who are looking at it maybe through a slightly more investment-driven frame. And that you do see that differentiation in price. It makes it exciting as well. I think there are still, in a rising market and in a market that's already risen an awful lot, exciting things that you can buy that are comparatively cheaper than you might expect.
Andrew, do you want to give us another?
Well, can we just do, there are two more Porsches on this, but we may not get to the other one. There's a 964 Turbo on here. The Leichtbau, if I haven't pronounced that appallingly as well. And, you know, 964 Turbo, so like the ultimate version of the 964, so still rear drive, still single turbo, you know, massive boost, massive lag, proper handful to drive. I remember because I used to knock about them on a bit. €1 million. Is that because this is a very, very, very special example of that car, or does that reflect the fact that these cars are now just generally becoming much more revered?
That reflects general market trend, I think. And again, if you find the one that's relatively low mileage, hasn't had an accident, again, you can probably knock out a size.
I imagine that 964 turbos, I think that's probably a fairly small minority of cars that haven't been backwards off or something at some stage.
Exactly. And you get those. So the 964s had a real increase in values. We're starting to see it in 993s as well. Yeah. That's partially driven by the fact the US didn't get that many of these cars. Mm. And now at 25 years, they can go to the States. And so that always has an impact on pricing because the US is still a big, big driver of the classic car market. And I think the car, it's a special car. It's an end of an era. Okay, the 993 was your last air cooled, but the 964, still in the way it was fabricated, the conception is very, very close, isn't it, to the original 911?
Yeah, and also particularly with the turbo. You know, the 964 turbo, even the 993 turbo is a very sophisticated car, twin turbocharged, four-wheel drive. You know, a completely different animal to a 964 turbo. And if you really want that sort of big, brawny, scare yourself senseless 911, you know, the 964 turbo is pretty much the ultimate example of that before Porsche suddenly thought, might have gone a bit far here. And actually, you know, put two little turbos on there rather than one big one and drove it at both ends and calmed the whole thing down a bit. So I think that for a certain sort of customer, it is a kind of ultimate.
It is, yeah, absolutely. No, it's the ultimate of that, relatively analog, really analog, actually, when you look at it, as you say. Yeah. It's fundamentally a very, very developed version of a much, much earlier car. So, an interesting thing. And it has a certain look. The styling, the 964 styling, I think, maybe that's me personally, there was a point where I didn't like that. And I think now, particularly alongside the larger modern sports cars that are produced by Porsche and Ferrari, these cars look so small and nimble, and they look quite elegant in a way they just didn't 10 years ago.
Paul, to wrap things up, is there one more car that you want to pull out for us to have a quick natter about?
Andrew knows that I like French cars. I think you like French cars as well, and we are in Paris.
So there's
always a car, we always talk in the team, which car are we going to take home from the auction, the dream world? And for me on this one, there is a black Renault 5 Turbo, Turbo 2 actually, but with a Turbo 1 interior from the factory.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, there we are, which was specified by a member of the Altani family who particularly wanted that Turbo 1 interior in it.
Which was quite a mad interior, wasn't it? If you go, Turbo 2 interior is like pretty standard Renault 5 with a boost gauge. Turbo 1 interior looks like a concept car, doesn't it? It's a really, really bonkers interior.
Totally bonkers, like offset central steering wheel, almost sort of like Citroen-esque steering wheel in there. The inset dials and the seats, which yes, look like they've stepped straight out of a sort of a TGV train circa 1980, sort of striped and mixtures of materials in there. I mean, terribly built, obviously, but rather a fabulous thing of its era. You know, it's not the most valuable car in the sale, but it's a bit of a cult car, and I like the unique specification of that. So,
what's that guiding at?
We're just over 100,000 euros on that.
Okay.
So again, finding a good example of a Renault 5 Turbo 1 or 2 is not as easy as it was. Those sort of homologation cars, the 80s, like the F40, that everything of that era has come up.
Yeah.
And I suppose that is at the more accessible end of it.
And I guess a few of those have been through hedges as well. So having a nice unmolested version. The other thing about this is this a standard car, or has it been tweaked? Because so many of them got sort of tuned up, didn't they? Because I think they had like 160 horsepower from that 1.4 liter pushrod Renault engine as standard. But you know, you see lots of cars saying that they've got over 200 horsepower and this sort of thing. And is this a sort of car that's been worked on, or is it pretty much
this one's standard factory tune, which I suppose for a collector is more desirable.
Yeah.
I've never actually driven a 5 turbo. I imagine fairly terrifying when it comes on the boost,
I have driven one, and yes, it's another one of those sort of all or nothing machines. Definitely, and obviously very, very short wheelbase. I think when they were new, they also came on those Michelin TRX tires, which were quite challenging all by themselves. So yes, you could get yourself into a world of pain in them, but an amazing looking car. And it's just one of those cars, I just think it's just so great that they exist. Same with the Clio V6. It's just, you know, it's just wonderful that somebody thought, that's a good idea, we'll do that. And obviously there's that great rallying heritage to go with it. And yeah, cracking car.
Yeah. So if you want to terrify yourself, we've got something for you at Bonhams. Fear not. at every price point.
That's the new strap line, isn't it? So Bonhams.com, if you want to know more, there is a link in the description. This sale runs from 1st to 2nd of February later on this week. Paul, good luck with it all, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Many thanks indeed.
Thank you very much. Been a real pleasure. Yeah, thanks a lot.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.